This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Choco Perfection, the only sugar-free chocolate sweetened from chicory root fiber. It doesn't raise blood sugar levels, and it supports the growth of beneficial probiotic flora. Choco Perfection supports weight loss as part of a low-carb eating program. Plus, it has all the beneficial antioxidants of chocolate. And it tastes great, like a really good chocolate bar. Just in time for Valentine's Day, you can get free 3-day shipping. To order, go to ChocoPerfection.com. That's ChocoPerfection.com or call 800-332-1773. That's 800-332-1773 for Choco Perfection. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to tackle an issue which I think is of utmost importance because we often advocate for a low-carb diet, a diet that may include elements of healthy meat. But there's a big debate about meat, whether meat can in fact be healthy, and in addition, whether meat can be sustainable. You know, some people argue that the planet cannot sustain a lot of people who shop at Whole Foods and buy grass-fed beef. It's just not practical. We've got to go more vegetarian. We've got to curb our environmentally expensive meat production. And today we're going to talk to an expert who's written a book entitled Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. She is Nicolette Hahn Nyman, and if the name sounds familiar, that's actually a brand of grass-fed and organic meat that you can find at a lot of natural food stores across the country. Nicolette Hahn Nyman previously served as senior attorney for the Waterkeeper Alliance, which is an environmental group, actually. She ran its campaign to reform the industrialized production of livestock and poultry. And she has gained a national reputation as an advocate for sustainable food production and as well for animal welfare, because that's a concern, too. The horrible conditions under which animals are raised in industrialized farms is deplorable, and that's an issue, too, one strike against the meat industry. She has written for numerous publications. She's appeared in the New York Times, the LA Times, Huffington Post, the Atlantic Online, and hither, thither, and yon. And now she's got a book entitled Defending Beef. Welcome to Intelligent Medicine, Nicolette. It's a pleasure having you on the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Okay, so look, sustainable meat production. Now, for a lot of people, that sounds like an oxymoron because we now have dietary guidelines in this country that call for Americans to somewhat reduce their animal protein intake, and for two reasons. One, they say it's unhealthy. Americans eat too much meat, too much fat, too much cholesterol. But at the same time, there's a dual agenda. They say it protects the environment because we are ravaging our environment with eating high on the food chain. It's expensive. It's devastating in terms of pollution. It even hastens global warming. So you're up against some real prevailing thought patterns in bucking this tide.
I agree, and that's really what prompted me to write the book because, and I have an earlier book called Righteous Pork Chop, which is kind of just talking about the way America produces its meat today and what some of the problems are that result from the prevailing methods. But as I argued in my first book, and I argue again in this second book, there's an incredible difference in terms of the healthfulness of the food that one produces and in terms of the ecological impact, depending on how one raises the animals. So I was, as you mentioned in your introduction, I was the senior attorney for the Waterkeeper Alliance Environmental Organization for 2 years. And during that time, I focused entirely on the issue of pollution and ecological damage from the livestock and poultry and dairy industries. And it was during that time that I came to believe that the impacts were radically different, the ecological impacts, because while a sort of industrialized form of production was really very problematic from an environmental standpoint, the most ecologically beneficial form of animal or farming, actually, food production, really does include animals. So you have kind of these opposite ends of the spectrum. On the one hand, they can be very damaging, but on the other hand, the best form of food production requires the presence of animals.
Well, another way of saying that is, you know, a lot of people would say, well, let's get rid of animal production. Let's just plant our fields with high-yield vegetable protein like soybeans and grow berries and vegetables and turn people into vegans, and that'll be better for the land and better for the people. I think that's the contention of a lot of folks in the environmental movement.
And, you know, I hear that a lot. And the thing about that is that's actually, that's such a gross oversimplification of the way nature works, of the way agriculture works, of the way food systems work, that it's actually radically wrong.
Okay.
Because there are things that I talk in quite a bit of detail about this in Defending Beef. There are many differences between the agriculture that produces plants and the agriculture that produces animals, and there are contributions that can be made for animals that simply cannot come. So I'll just give you, cannot come from plants. I'll give you just one example. I was just talking with someone the other day about the drought here in California, and the person said, well, isn't it problematic to have cattle in California now because they're water intensive? And I said, well, you know, first of all, they're not nearly as water intensive as people tend to think, so I address that issue. And then I talked about the fact that when you have livestock, it's actually much more flexible than crop cultivation. So the fact that people, many people in California right now are actually reducing their cattle herd sizes because of the, there's less forage available and there's less water available. And that's exactly what you should do. That's what nature would do in this situation. When there was less forage available and less water to drink, animals would naturally die. And you have that same kind of flexibility. If you're raising a plant crop, you're going to need the same amount of water every year to raise that plant crop. You can't just simply reduce your herd size. So there are just many sort of flexibilities that you get with animals that you don't have with plants. And animals add fertility back into the food system in a way, back to the soil, in a way that vegetable production can't do.
Well, a lot of people would say that, you know, one of the reasons that we had environmental devastation like the Dust Bowl is because we took a lot of forested land, we chopped down the trees, we turned it into grazing pasture, the cows ate it all up, and sort of a simplistic view of how we destroyed the virgin primeval forest that once was North America.
Well, and in fact, they've got about half right there. So there were vast grasslands covering much of the globe. Grass has evolved around 60 million years ago. So there is this misperception that the globe was entirely covered with forests and humans came in and chopped those down and that created these open areas. That's not true. There were dramatic ecological sort of changes in the conditions right around the same time that the dinosaurs disappeared, actually, that led to the emergence of grasses in an evolutionary sense. And that was about 60 million years ago. And shortly after they emerged, they began covering a lot of the land surface of the globe. Today, grasses cover about 40% of the globe. And some of that is areas where humans have cleared the trees, and some of it is areas that were never forested. I mean, never in the last 60 million years, at least. So, what you had in the Great Plains, for example, where you had these huge buffalo herds, and where it eventually led to the creation of the Dust Bowl, was you had huge herds of grazing animals creating and maintaining these vast open spaces, and in fact, it was one of the richest soils in the entire world.
It was created a complete ecosystem consisting of plants and animals in continuous balance and interaction.
Exactly. There was the bison were doing the sort of function that grazing animals do the world over and have for millions and millions of years. I mean, ruminants evolved 90 million years ago, actually. They even evolved before grasses emerged. But they've been on the globe for, you know, literally for eons. And what they've always done is with the action of clipping the plants, with the action of pressing vegetative matter into the soils and pressing seeds into the soils, and with the action of eating vegetation and returning it back to the soil in the form of manure, which is a really sort of biousable, bioavailable form of the nutrients for the soils and for all the vegetation, they have these, you know, many very big impacts on where, you know, whatever lands that they're on. And that's what created these many impacts, created these incredibly rich soils in the Great Plains. And then when the people started moving west in that big migration in the early 20th century and began actually plowing lands that had been grasslands for millions of years, they very quickly turned it into the Dust Bowl that we saw. And that was probably the most dramatic historical example of the difference that a plowed area has ecologically versus an area that is kept in grass. And the protective benefits of grass and grazing animals that maintain that is really well illustrated in that historical example. And there was a huge amount of government action and agricultural shifting that had to occur to undo the damage. It's never really been fully undone, but to try to reverse the damage that was done when the Great Plains were plowed for the first time. So the plow is probably the single most destructive thing that the humans have done to the globe.
And possibly, and from the standpoint of people who believe in grain brain or the gluten connection, it's created quite a toll in terms of human misery and disease. One argument that's made by environmentalists, and this particularly by people who believe that human activity is contributing to the warming of the globe, the so-called global warming or climate change movement, is that all these grazing animals, well, they release a lot of gas, methane gas, which somehow rises in the atmosphere and creates a greenhouse effect. And that's part of the problem. It's not just those factories belching smoke into the air. It's those herds of cattle and pigs and chickens that are creating a problem.
Well, like so many other issues, there's a little bit of truth to all of that, but it's been grossly oversimplified. So ruminants, including cattle, do produce methane, but the amount of methane that actually is produced by them is incredibly variable depending on, when you're talking about domesticated animals, depending on how they're managed, what they're eating, how well managed they are as far as their movements on the grasses. And there's actually very good research that's been shown by soil scientists that has shown that when you have very well healthy grazing lands, it actually counteracts a lot of the methane that is produced by the grazing animals, and so it actually offsets quite a bit of it.
So you're saying that actually what they feed on may influence their emissions. I mean, we get kind of, we also have the human analogy of dysbiosis or, bacterial overgrowth. And, some people contend that feeding animals corn feed is not necessarily a natural feed. Grass is the natural feed of ruminants, changes the gastrointestinal flora, causes more gas production. You're saying that if they are raised on grass, it mitigates this problem?
Well, there's contradictory evidence on that point, actually. But as far as the elements that are in the soil, the microorganisms in the soil, there are microorganisms in the soil that actually counteract methane that is produced from the animal's gut flora. And it's a fairly emerging area of science. I don't think this is something that a lot of research has been done on it yet, but Dr. Christine Jones out of Australia has done some of the groundbreaking research on that point and has demonstrated that. There's just a lot about this that is unknown, but what's really interesting is that in the United States, methane is declining, actually, and global methane is quite stable. So when you hear about, you know, the sort of the global warming gases, really methane is not really an active concern. I'm not saying it's not an issue that people should be thinking about, but the total amount of methane in the world is stable, and the amount that's being produced in the United States is going down. So I don't think it's wise for people to focus on the methane question regardless. But moreover, as you mentioned, there were many more ruminants on the globe than there are today, and we didn't have the problems that are being attributed to global warming today from methane and nitrous oxide and carbon dioxide. So I just don't think it makes a lot of sense to focus on the methane from ruminants.
What about the notion that, you know, this movement towards grass-fed beef and organic beef is rather an effete movement, because, you know, if it's okay for people who live in Marin County who can go to their local Whole Foods and pay $29.99 per pound for organic filet mignon, I don't know, maybe it's more by now, but, you know, for the ordinary person who's on a budget, they need to go to McDonald's and, you know, get a Big Mac that's made in an industrialized farm because it's cheaper that way.
Well, I think that's a really unfortunate byproduct of, you know, the way agriculture is subsidized in this country today. It's true.
So there are perverse incentives to make that cheaper and more available.
Exactly. We've been subsidizing grain for decades in this country, and that has led not just to, you know, tremendous ecological destruction where that grain is being produced. I mean, it's the leading cause of the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico now is believed to be the runoff from the grain and soy that's being produced in the upper Midwest, and a lot of that is being used to feed to animals. So that's just not a sensible policy from an ecological standpoint. But also, you're producing food that is not as healthful, especially when you're talking about grazing animals who really could be raised entirely on forages, including, obviously, lots of grass. And so I think there's nothing inherently about grass-fed cattle that should be more expensive. I mean, if you didn't have the various incentives, and if you didn't have the lack of enforcement of environmental regulations that really do cover a lot of the pollution but are not being enforced, there shouldn't be a big price differential today. Now, the world over, about 75% of the cattle are raised entirely on grass. So there is kind of a misperception that there's only, you know, there's this tiny little, you know, Marin County type product that a small percentage of people are able to afford. Really, most of the world's cattle are raised entirely in grass, and we just need to move things more in that direction in the United States, because it's the right thing to do from an ecological standpoint, and it does produce healthier food.
What about the animal cruelty angle? You know, is it possible to humanely raise and then ultimately slaughter animals? Because, you know, the conditions in industrialized factories are really deplorable. They're the subject of many books, you know, from Upton Sinclair's The Jungle to modern movies that are exposés about modern meat production.
Yeah, and I would include my first book, Righteous Porkchop, as really having focused on that as well. I focused on both the humane treatment issues as well as the ecological questions in that book. And my contention then, and I still believe very much today, is that we have a choice as a society as far as what type of meat production we're going to have and what kind of dairy production. We've gone down this pathway largely because of the incentives we were just talking about, the agricultural subsidies and so forth. That has led us into this industrialized model. But we can just as easily choose as a society to go in a totally different way with animal food production. And I think because the food is so nutritious and because there are tremendous ecological benefits to having animals in the food system, we need to make that shift. Just simply getting rid of animals doesn't solve the problem. And in fact, if we do that, we really forego the opportunity to have the most ecologically sound food system, and we lose the opportunity to have a great deal of extremely nutritious food that we really need in the food system.
Well, you yourself have a personal saga in relationship to this. You're an avowed former vegetarian who has now turned into an advocate for sustainable meat production. Tell us about your own personal transformation there.
Well, I'm still a vegetarian, but I've always eaten eggs and dairy, and I still do that. And I have two young sons that are both younger than 6 years old, and they both are meat eaters, because I consider meat an extremely nutritious food, and when it is well raised, a very, very helpful food. And my own diet, I haven't shifted back to meat, I think largely just because I've been eating a vegetarian diet for a very long time, and I'm very comfortable and used to that. But I am increasingly convinced that the optimal diet, the optimal human diet, does include foods from animals and meat, and definitely beef as well as part of that, because there are so many differences between, and I'm sure, you know, you talk about this, I'm sure, a lot on your program, but there are tremendous differences in terms of the quality of the nutrients that are contained in meat versus, vegetable forms of these foods, whether it's the protein or the iron or the zinc or the B12, it's very hard to get what your body really needs, especially for young people that are still developing, growing, and for older people who need more protein and more nutrients. And so I'm a very big supporter of meat in the food system.
And so what's the big distinction between grass-fed or organic, say beef for the sake of argument, versus conventional beef? A lot of people are confused by that distinction. I've coined the phrase, and I don't think it's been used elsewhere, it's not you are what you eat, it's you are what you eat eats, because it really affects the composition of the food.
There are a number of nutrients that are higher in grass-fed beef, and these have been quantified in various studies. Vitamin A and the precursor to vitamin A has been shown to be higher in grass-fed beef. There's a higher omega-3 content, and there's a what's considered a more favorable ratio of omega-3 to omega-6 fats, etc. There are a number of differences of that type. For me, what I think is the most persuasive is the fact that when you get totally grass-fed beef, especially if you're familiar with, if you really know how it was raised, and you know the story behind that beef, you can be assured that you're not getting things you don't want to have in there. So a lot of beef in the United States today, the majority of beef cattle today, are given growth hormones. But I'm not aware of anyone that's raising totally grass-fed beef that's doing that. So that's a good way to make sure you avoid that, any potential residues from growth hormones. Similarly, antibiotic feeding is fairly common in feedlots, and along with the grains and the soy, they're also feeding antibiotics.
It doesn't just protect the animals from infections. I understand it also makes the animals grow bigger and fatter.
Right, exactly. And it's done in the poultry and in the pork industry and in the cattle industry. The cattle industry is actually the smallest user of antibiotics in that way. It's the most prevalent in the chicken and turkey and pig industry, where it's almost universal. It's less common in the cattle industry, but it's still very common. So, again, there's a potential to be exposed to the drug residues or the antibiotic-resistant bacteria on the meat if you're eating food that's produced in those conventional methods, what's now, unfortunately, the conventional method of raising those animals. So, to me, if you buy grass-fed beef, you are going to get a somewhat better nutritional profile in the meat, but even more importantly, you can be assured that you're going to get a product that doesn't have the things in it that you don't want in your food.
And what about the notion of eating high in the food chain? You know, this notion that the things that are, small, short-lived animals or plants are less likely to bioaccumulate the toxins, the environmental toxins in our environment. But if you, it's sort of like eat small fish, don't eat large fish, don't eat large predatory fish because they accumulate PCBs and mercury and whatnot from the ocean. What about, large land animals? Do they pose the same problems?
Well, again, if you're eating totally grass-fed beef, that's one way to really mitigate your exposure to that, because it's not that there couldn't be any toxins on the forage of the animal they're foraging, but essentially you're going to have much less likelihood that you're being especially if you're seeking out something where you know that there were never any agricultural chemicals applied to the land, for example. So, like, our cattle are raised entirely on forages. They are given some hay, but they are about 99% of their diet is just from naturally occurring forage, and that's all they ever eat. So there really isn't an opportunity for anything to accumulate in their fat tissue or their fat or their muscle tissue or their organs. And actually, I was reading something recently by Chris Kresser, who you're probably familiar with, who does
has
a really good blog, and he was talking about the actual toxins in things like liver and so forth, and was talking about how these are very, very low and pretty much almost non-existent in grass-fed beef. So I think even the organ meat is very clean when you're talking about totally grass-fed.
Yeah, that's very reassuring to hear. Well, this is a logical inflection point for us to pause, because we generally divide these podcasts into two parts. So in part two, we'll talk more about organic and grass-fed meats and how to source them and how to know if you're getting the real thing, what some of the regulations are and some considerations if you're going to the market. But we'll also talk about health claims against beef, because beef has gotten a bad rap. And in your book, Defending Beef, you make a good case for debunking some of those anti-beef claims. Our guest is Nicolette Hahn Nyman, and she's the author of Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. In just a moment, if you rejoin us, we'll be right back with part two of today's discussion here on Intelligent Medicine. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.